From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Morning, Vermont. It is Thursday, the 23rd of July, 2020, and really appreciate you tuning in this morning to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM. We have a good full show lined up for you this morning. We're going to be speaking first off with our good friend Steve Pappas. He's the editor and publisher of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald, and then in the second half hour, we're going to be speaking with Debbie Ingram. She is a Democratic Lieutenant Gubernatorial candidate, currently a state senator representing Chittenden County in the Vermont Senate. Later on, after the mid-show break, we're going to have a conversation with one of our CBS News correspondents, and then we're going to be speaking with poet Scudder Parker. Scudder lives in Middlesex. He is actually a former longtime state employee. He was director of energy efficiency programs for the Department of Public Service for quite a while. Prior to that, he had served as a state senator from Caledonia County, and earlier in his career, he had been a minister in a Protestant church. I don't remember the denomination right now, but maybe we can ask him about that. And so that'll be an interesting conversation with a newly published poet. He has a terrific collection out that we're going to be talking about in that second hour of today's program. Let's get right into it, if we can, with Steve Pappas, who is on the line with us this morning. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing well. It's an interesting edition of the Times Argus this morning. I was just looking at it earlier and noting that your lead story is really about an unfortunate event, shall we say? This inmate up in the Newport prison who is now said by the Defender General's office to have had improper care before he ended up dying.
Yeah, I mean it's. I don't know a lot about that story beyond what was in that Associated Press article by Lisa Rathke, but it sounds as if this was a person of color and an inmate at the Newport facility that had a medical emergency and was having difficulty breathing and did not feel that he received the adequate care that he needed, and that's under investigation at this point. And there's been an initial report out that seems to confirm that that the protocol may not have been exactly run as it should. But yeah, it's a tough issue because not just because of the social unrest that we're seeing right now, but because there have been lots of concerns in recent years about our corrections facilities, not just in-state, but the out-of-state facilities where Vermont prisoners are being held, and whether prisoner rights are and kind of those protocols are being adhered to, and that people are being treated equitably. There was at least a report a couple years ago that was highly critical, actually, of I believe it was the women's prison system or the women's facility here in Vermont, and there were certain calls for reforms as a result of that. But yeah, it's a difficult issue in a difficult time, and I've had a few people reach out to me this morning and say, did you feel like you overplayed that story a bit? You're trying to sell papers by making it look like inmates are dying in the prison system, and that's not why it rose to the level of being the top story in the paper today. It just feels like there are a lot of issues that combine and converge into one that make that a story worth paying attention to, and it'll be interesting to see how it develops over the next few weeks and months.
Yeah, certainly a black man complaining that he can't breathe has unfortunate echoes and sort of connotations, particularly in relation to our criminal justice system. We've had, of course, two now cases, nationally recognized cases of police killings of unarmed black suspects who were complaining that they couldn't breathe while in the case of a New York, Eric Garner, a New York Police Department officer, had him in a chokehold, and he ended up dying. And, of course, now George Floyd out in Minneapolis, similar fate, complaining on the way that he couldn't breathe. And this gentleman, Kenneth Johnson, 60 years old, was actually detained at the Northern State Correctional Facility in Newport while awaiting trial. So he hadn't even been convicted yet, apparently, from this report by the AP. He ended up once the state takes custody of an individual, the state has certain responsibilities to that individual, as that's generally how the law reads. And among the responsibilities the state has is to make sure that if the individual needs medical care, that happens. And we've had a few cases now in recent years. I know in the case of the out-of-state prison the state was sending people to down in Pennsylvania for a couple of years, there were a couple of inmate deaths down there, and the same issues arose about worries about inadequate health care delivery to these folks, and maybe some allegations by staff that wasn't as serious as the inmate or the inmate's cellmate was indicating. And it's getting to be, I don't want to say an old story, but a multiply repeated story. I'm curious to know what our listeners think. 244-1777 is the call-in number here in Waterbury. The toll-free number 1-877-291-8255. And so let's see
David,
here. Sorry?
I just wanted to add that it is worth noting that the AP story today is not a story. The gentleman who was having the issue was not having an issue because of any kind of force being brought upon him. This was just a case of him raising an issue about having what he felt was a health situation that needed attention. It wasn't, nobody's knee was on him. It was nothing of that sort.
No, you're right. And I don't mean to conflate to that extent, because the only point I was making was that, it just, you were talking about the various factors that may have moved the story toward the top of the front page, shall we say. And one of them, of course, is that there is this commonality with an inability to breathe, as unfortunate as you have to, you have to note that. It's unfortunate that we do. But right. Beyond that, you're right. There was no allegation of a physical confrontation of any kind between this inmate and staff at the prison or whatever. There certainly, the issue here, and as in the cases at that Camp Hill prison down in Pennsylvania where Vermont inmates were housed for a while, was just when, people get sick in prison. And then once they get sick, the state is in charge of their lives. They have no money. They have no ability to go see a doctor or go to the ER or whatever. So once the person is in prison, the state then becomes sort of responsible for their care. And is that being delivered adequately? And I think that the allegation is here that, and in those Camp Hill cases, that the care was not being delivered adequately. Another interesting AP story on your front page this morning out of Boston. Headline is "Few in Favor of School Opening." This is a poll the AP did of people about the question of do we want to go back to school? It's basically starting next month, or in a few cases they wait till September. But and boy, there's a lot of concern out there. I hear it from teachers. I hear it from parents. I hear it from some kids. Although I think a lot of the kids that I speak to around here are sort of taking a fairly, I don't want to say lackadaisical, but relaxed approach. They're less worried than some of the adults who are dealing with the question of reopening schools. What are you hearing in your community, Steve?
Well, I'm gonna start off first at a kind of a higher level and talk about how I've been. This is the time of year where you're interviewing all of the various candidates for statewide office, and Almost all of those folks who I've talked to in the last few weeks have said that one of the greatest concerns for working Vermonters right now, and even not working Vermonters, is the safety concern about putting their kids back in school, but also what they do if the kids don't go back to school because of the challenges that that potentially puts on households to do the remote learning again, what that means for, you know, a person potentially having to stay home and work or not work at all and take, you know, assist the kids again through that process, especially with kind of the federal subsidy on unemployment going away at the end of this month, that creates a different kind of fiscal challenge. And then I'm hearing a lot from educators. Everyone from para educators and school nurses all the way up to tenured teachers in the school systems who, you know, have done this for a very long time. And, you know, some have written eloquently about their concerns to the paper and on social media. And those have been widely circulated. In a few instances, there's been, a handful of teachers who, have really put it out there that they are concerned, in part because the decisions that are being made are kind of piecemeal in the school districts. The different various school districts are coming up with even though there's a framework for what the guidelines need to be, it's a very customized approach for different schools, in part because some schools are smaller than others. Some schools have different abilities for laying out classrooms than other schools. And the agency of education is kind of making concessions for that. But overall, I think that teachers are very concerned and educators are very concerned about what this is going to look like, especially since in other parts of the country, it does feel like it's a different story. And the fragile bubble that we have of security in Vermont right now is somewhat, it's a little tenuous. We don't know what is going to happen over the next few weeks, but it certainly would suggest that with more out-of-staters here, with students coming in from out-of-state, and all those variables, that we could see an increase of positive cases in Vermont. And, as soon as that happens, the discussion gets a little more shrill again. And, we're a little, I like to say that we're a little blessed in that we have such low numbers, but it provides a false sense of security. And I think that the teachers and the various educators who are talking about this issue right now, because it's pressing, we're coming right up on it. They are the ones who are now really thinking hard about, is this something that I want to do? And I haven't talked to anybody in our areas of the Rutland Herald and the Times Argus who have teachers who are actually leaving the profession over the threat. But I have heard anecdotally that there are teachers who have just said, look, I'm not going to go back. It's not worth it to put myself and my family at risk. And that AP poll certainly had some references. It's worth reading for folks because it does raise a host of issues of kind of what the concerns are, not just for parents, but for schools. And, it's very complicated. And I think that the complexity of all of the issues related to COVID and education are only going to be, it's only going to, it's so fluid. I don't think we can actually put a concrete plan into place because we don't know. And what happens if one classroom has an outbreak but another doesn't? What happens if one school has an outbreak and the rest of the district doesn't? Just a lot of variables at play. And you can't even plan for contingencies. Your book on contingencies would be it would look like War and Peace. So
yeah, that is for sure. Or maybe, what is it, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, one of these 1,200-page tomes. Yikes. We have a caller on the line. I believe Margaret wants to talk to us about the conversation we just had on the story relating to the inmate who died up in Newport in the prison up there.
I'm on the phone here now.
Good morning, Margaret.
Hello. Hello. How are you?
Doing well. How are you?
Well, got my chores done, so I'm doing all right. Anyway, I had a comment on health care in the prisons.
Mm-hmm.
I have a dear friend who is incarcerated in the woman's prison, and she has had some health issues over the last couple of years. She's been taken to the emergency room 3 times for an issue over the last couple of years, and mm-hmm. was told 2 years ago that she needed to have surgery.
Hmm.
And it's still taking this long. Hopefully she's on the list to have it done soon, but their soon is completely different than our soon.
Yeah.
And one of the tests that she needed to have before the surgeon would operate was a colonoscopy, which took quite a while to schedule.
Yeah.
And, you know, they found precancerous polyps. You know, this is a young woman who's in her 30s, and you would not expect that.
You wouldn't, no.
You know, so here's this person who should have been diagnosed much earlier. But, you know, that's just one instance. Another instance, she had some dental work, and she got an infection through the needle injection. She was treated by the dentist and given a course of antibiotics, and then later it started acting up again.
Hmm.
So she, you know, she ended up having to go back. And the doctor's there, well, you only took this medicine. Why didn't you take the other medicine? And, you know, number one, they don't have access to their medical records, so they have no idea what they're supposed to be doing to begin with unless somebody tells them. Nobody told her there was a second medication.
Huh.
And, you know, so here we had, they were originally thinking they were going to have to take out some teeth because of the infection.
Wow.
Fortunately, they didn't have to. But it's very slipshod, and it's, I said, they have absolutely no idea what's in their medical records.
Well, I think you raise a really important issue here, which is that, and I've heard this over and over again from families of inmates, friends of inmates, that, and from the prisoners' rights section of the Defender General's Office, that the health care being offered our inmates is not really up to standard. It's supposed to be on par with what is offered in the community. And that is too often not the case. I think that there's a sense by some in our society and maybe in our government that inmates are somehow, you know, less valued than others or whatever, or it's a cost to government. We try to trim it where we can, et cetera. That's a problem. So I appreciate you pointing out this other case of what sounds like less than optimum healthcare for this person. So thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Bye.
All right. Steve Pappas, interesting editorial page today. We have your house editorial on this phenomenon of federal, I don't know whether to call them police or secret police or troops or exactly what they are, but going to cities around the country, and according to the president and the administration, they are trying to supplement local law enforcement efforts against surges in crime. And according to local officials, in at least some places, they're not wanted. They are unwelcome. They are basically violating the normal relationship between the government and the citizens. What's going on out there?
Yeah, if I had that answer, Dave, I would not be talking to you. I would be living somewhere on a beach.
Uh-huh.
So, what's happening is that, as you kind of laid out, there are these agents of some kind that are working for the government, and they're basically, a lot of the discussion is centered around these protests in Portland that have been going on now for several weeks, and have taken on kind of you know, because they're happening on a daily basis, they've taken on a bit of a show factor, and both on both sides, both with the protesters and with the folks who are trying to kind of corral the protesters. But for the most part, these protests have been peaceful. But apparently, the administration does not feel that that the local police have been able to handle the situation. So they have been brought in, and they're looking at bringing in federal agents to protests in Chicago and Albuquerque as well. And so what's ended up happening out of this is are questions being raised about who are these people, who's paying for these people, you know, what is this, you know, what is this all about? And nobody has a firm answer. The head of Homeland Security for the Trump administration is saying that he's well within his right to do this, but now there are questions about whether or not that's the case. And I just put it out there in the editorial that, you know, there are a lot of things that are kind of freaking people out right now about between the coronavirus and the election and, you know, just all these different things. And this piece of it is really pretty scary, that all of a sudden we're having unnamed, unidentified people coming in and hauling people off the streets, firing tear gas in the crowds. And if we're getting to a point where that is going to be the norm in what appears to be places where there are regular protests and kind of folks standing up and being active, that Vermonters probably actually ought to be a little concerned about that, because we are a state where, for the most part, we are willing to stand up and protest about a host of issues, whether it's race issues or social unrest or income inequality, you know, minimum wage, you name it, gun control. We show up. And we show up sometimes in pretty good-sized numbers in communities all around Vermont, and we are a state that is unafraid to use its voice. And I think that if there are states being and communities that are being targeted, and certainly states with a more democratic or liberal bent, I think that we could see down the road. Vermont certainly being identified as a place where, you know, maybe those Vermonters don't need to be so.
Well, when these people are rounded up and taken off somewhere, are they charged with a crime?
We don't really know. It's kind of a mixed bag. It sounds like some of them are being detained. It sounds like the charges are ranging from disorderly conduct, but often are escalating to other charges of assault and things where there's no witnesses to what happened. But, I mean, it's just a range. It's a little hard to discern who, you know, what to believe and what's going on. But, I mean, the bottom line is that we probably shouldn't be allowing citizens to be plucked off the street during peaceful protests, that's the overarching concern, that if that's the level of comfort that we're starting to, or discomfort that we're starting to get close to, then you know, these really are pretty tenuous times.
Yeah, I think that is something which, you know, could violate some very fundamental tenets of American jurisprudence and law when you have a authorities seizing somebody without any real accountability at all. I mean, that's just you know, I suppose somebody could come into the studio here and grab me just for having said that, you know, and who knows? I mean, that's if that's what we're coming to, these are dangerous times, and I think that the American people had better sit up and take notice. So, and also, people shouldn't be ready to allow this to happen to people you disagree with politically. I think people need to be defending the principle. So, hey, Steve Pappas, I got to go, but I really appreciate you spending some time with us this morning. Steve Pappas is the editor of the Times, Argus, and Rutland Herald. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Dave.
All righty. We're going to go to a bottom of the hour break for some CBS News. And when we return, we're going to be speaking with Debbie Ingram, a Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor of Vermont.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Deli takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
We are back, and thanks for staying with us into this second half hour of our program on this Thursday morning. And going to be talking with Debbie Ingram. She is a Democratic candidate for Lieutenant Governor of Vermont, and she is currently a state senator from Chittenden County, serving in the Vermont Senate, and looking to move up to presiding officer, I guess, over the Senate. That is a key duty of the lieutenant governor. The lieutenant governor actually is generally the person up at the podium in front of the Senate, sort of conducting the sessions and calling on people to stand and offer their points in debate, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an important job that way. The lieutenant governor historically has also maintained an office in the state house and has been someone who has tried to work with Vermonters to promote business, promote good government, and promote general well-being of our citizens in a variety of different ways. They have a fairly open portfolio when the legislature is not in session and kind of follow their own interests. Famously, a previous holder of the office, Phil Scott, who's now our governor, used to go out on trips around the state and do a job for a day. He would basically sign up as some kind of a laborer in various places or office worker, you name it, and basically try out a different lines of work. And it was a good way for him to get to kind of meet and greet a lot of different Vermonters in different walks of life. And so we'll talk to Debbie Ingram about what some of her plans along those lines, if any, might be. I believe she's on the phone with us, and let's get right at it. Debbie Ingram, thank you very much for joining me.
It's great to be here, Dave. Thank you.
And you are running for Lieutenant Governor of Vermont. I guess the first basic question is why? Why are you running for this office?
Well, I think that the opportunities that the office affords and the few designated duties that there are a very good match for my skill sets. As you were saying, presiding over the Senate is one designated duty, voting in case of a tie, filling in if the governor's out of state, or if we're stepping in if, heaven forbid, the worst happened and the governor passed away. Those require somebody who has had experience in political office, and I think especially in the Senate, it's very helpful to have that experience. And so I do have all of that. I've been in the Senate for 4 years now, and I served on the Wilson Select Board and as executive director of a nonprofit before that. So that's part of the job, but the other part of the job is, as you were saying, you get to kind of make of it what you will. And I have worked, as an organizer and a communications person, and I think I'm a real people person, and I would like to use the office to draw attention to the issues that are most pressing in Vermont, and really go around, do town halls and forums, and talk to people on the ground who are experiencing the impacts of those issues. I've always found that the everyday folks who are right in the thick of things are the ones that we should be listening to. They understand the issues best, and they're most likely to have solutions, and I would want to bring those back to Montpelier.
And just by way of your own background, you don't sound like you're originally from Vermont, so talk to us a little bit about that. I see you were born in Savannah, Georgia, right?
That's right, yes. Yeah, no, I grew up in a small town, actually, outside of Savannah, and it was a rural area, farming community. My dad and granddad were farmers and small businessmen, and was a good preparation, actually, for Vermont, though. It's very similar in terms of, being a rural area. My parents were kind of dyed-in-the-wool FDR Democrats and really believe strongly in making sure that workers and labor unions and farmers and people who aren't traditionally thought of in our society as having power and wealth, that they got a fair shake. And my dad was mayor of our little town, actually. He died when I was 16, but certainly have always remembered what he taught me. And then I went on from that little town to California and to live overseas and then to choose Vermont as my home because I love it so much.
Why did you choose Vermont? What was it about if you were, I'm imagining you now overseas somewhere. And by the way, where were you?
I was in Bangladesh
actually, wow.
for 7 years, working for non-government organizations and various poverty alleviation projects.
And so were you zeroing in on Vermont while you were still in Bangladesh?
My now ex-partner and I were looking to get a civil union. So as soon as we were paying attention to what was going on in the States while we were living in Bangladesh,
mm-hmm.
and saw that Vermont had passed the civil unions law, and so we decided to get one and to come on vacation in 2000 to Vermont when that went into effect.
And wow, okay.
We went all over the state, and I fell in love with all four corners of the state at that time. And then when we moved back to the U.S. a couple of years later, we chose here.
Yeah, that makes sense. Did you later take advantage of the marriage equality law passed in 2009 here?
Well, no, unfortunately, we had split up by then.
I usually say
my relationship with my ex didn't go so well, but my relationship with Vermont has flourished.
Okay. Well, and it's, I guess you're probably in a fairly small category of people whose relationship kind of lasted for some of the civil unions period, but not all the way to marriage or something. I don't know. But
that may be, yes.
Yeah.
Have to do a study on that, right?
Yeah, I don't know, do some serious social science research or something. But here you are in Vermont. You settled in Williston, and you said you were with a nonprofit group. Was that here in Vermont? Did you do that for a while here?
Yes, and actually, I as you know, the legislature is not exactly a lucrative position, so most of us have other jobs, so I still do that other job. In fact, for 13 years, I've been the executive director of Vermont Interfaith Action,
mm-hmm.
which is a nonprofit. It's a collection of 60 congregations of different faiths all across the state. These are not judgmental or legalistic people of faith. They are caring and inclusive folks who want to affect systemic change around issues of social justice. So that has really informed my Senate work as well.
And you're actually an ordained minister, as I recall, in one of the Protestant denominations. Is that correct?
That is right, yes, in the United Church of Christ. All those congregational churches you see all across Vermont, most of them are UCC.
Yeah, okay. And is that a sort of a credential or a degree or whatever that you acquired here, or was that earlier in life?
That was earlier in life when I was in California after I graduated. Well, I've done all kinds of things. So after I first graduated from college, I worked in actually in Hollywood in the film and television business in production. Then I felt that I wanted to make a change, and I went to seminary in California and got ordained out there in the 80s. So
I see.
My ministry, I don't serve a church, but my ministry is recognized as being the executive director of Vermont Interfaith Action.
Well, you know, I'm going to get a little bit off on a tangent here just because I'm curious, but people talk a lot about in the United States the ascendant Christian right, which certainly came to the fore in the 80s with people like Jerry Falwell and Ralph Reed and others, Focus on the Family and Moral Majority and those groups. And I'm wondering sort of whether you think there is a Christian left out there, maybe quieter, and if so, does it need to be more vocal? What do you think about the whole application of your faith to your advocacy work and your political work?
Yeah, I would say that I work with kind of the Christian Christian left, and also the Jewish and Buddhist and Muslim left. We sure. are people who are very accepting of other religions and of other ideas, and the cornerstone of our faith, we believe, are compassion and justice. And so I would almost say we're kind of the antidote to the Christian right, not subscribing to the policies that they do at all. We are, I guess, quieter. We don't get quite as much press, but Vermont Interfaith Action actually belongs to a national network that's in 20 different states, and it's, our sister organizations are very similar. So there's a lot of people of faith out there who are distressed at the way the religions have kind of gotten co-opted by folks that they don't really agree with.
There's this discussion a lot about these days about this prosperity gospel, which seems to go to this idea that's popular on the Christian among the Christian right. I think that people are rewarded, get earthly rewards for good works, et cetera, and their wealth is, if they are wealthy, is justified, et cetera. Meanwhile, I think there's something in the scripture about how it's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich person to get into the kingdom of heaven. So how do you square all this?
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right, Dave. I would agree with you completely. I think there's far more in the Christian scriptures about helping the poor and about how the last shall be first, and that people who are rich and powerful should be wary than there is that we should all strive to be prosperous and wealthy.
Let's focus on some of the Vermont issues you would have to deal with as lieutenant governor, or even in between now and January when you would take office as lieutenant governor if you were to win the office. And a big one that is being discussed a lot right now is the question of, should schools reopen in about a month from now?
Yes, that is a very difficult question. I mean, I think it's downright frightening to think of sending our kids and educators and support staff into a situation that could be potentially, could potentially make them sick. So I think, I'm the vice chair of the Senate Education Committee, and we started having these conversations early on. The agency secretary came in, Dan French, and spoke with us, and we were asking him questions, 3 months ago about, are you going to make kids wear masks? How are you going to socially distance them in small classrooms? Are you going to take their temperature every morning when they show up to school? What are you going to do with a child who needs to go home, but his parents are, not able to, they're out working? There's just question after question after question. And, he said at that time the agency was trying to work out protocols, based on public health advice and science. But now we're getting closer to the time when the schools would start, and I don't think we have a lot of answers still. So I do wish that the agency would form some kind of task force and involve parents and educators in this decision-making, which they've so far resisted doing. But I'm very concerned about going back. And if they go back at all, I think it would certainly be better to have some kind of hybrid approach where there's some days that are remote, or some hours out of each day that are remote, and only under certain circumstances would they be able to meet in person. It's very tricky, but we need to be careful.
Let's go to the whole question of the state's finances, and I don't expect you to have down to the nickels and dimes here, but as a general rule, as Vermont tries to recover, the state, tries to recover from the fiscal shocks of months without real revenues from the rooms and meals taxes, and significantly reduced sales tax revenues, the giant budget hole that lawmakers are going to be dealing with when they return in the latter part of August, should that be addressed mainly with tax increases or mainly with revenue, with spending cuts?
Well, I think that the whole concept of austerity is something that we need to really avoid completely. I think that's the absolute opposite of what we need to do. And so making huge cuts, I am very much against that and will advocate against that. I think there are several things that we can do before we make cuts. One is we really need to look to the federal government and put pressure on them, now while we know the administration, but even, in the future, no matter who gets elected, we need to put pressure on them to provide more relief packages and stimulus packages. Secondly, we need to look to our reserves. Vermont has very healthy reserves, and prudent use of those, I think, would make a lot of sense. Third, bonding. I would look at bonding, borrowing. I think that would, in the long run, be better for Vermonters than making cuts that will damage people further. And then fourth, I would look at our taxation system, whether we have some kind of smelling surcharge on the very highest income earners, or we actually make more long-range changes to those highest brackets, because those folks got the biggest benefits from the federal tax cuts. But I really don't want to make cuts that will hurt people who are already experiencing very difficult times.
The federal stimulus of part of the federal stimulus packages that runs out this week, I believe it is the $600 bonus people who are getting state unemployment have been collecting from the federal government. Do you think that that needs to be continued? Should the state backfill it if the federal government doesn't? Or should the state backfill it to a certain extent, maybe partially? What do you think about all that?
Yeah, I did see, I got a notification on my phone this morning that it looks like that maybe in Washington they're moving closer to some kind of extension of relief package. Certainly I think the federal government is in a much better position to make those kinds of payments than the state, people still need those, and I would definitely look to see what we could do in the state to at least partially pay that. If the federal government doesn't come through.
Another topic, there was actually kind of an interesting question last Friday in the governor's news conference from Guy Page, a conservative blogger here in Vermont, who was asking about the AOT, the Transportation Agency removed some kind of a painting or graffiti in a roadway down in southern Vermont, which said BLM is racist. And the question from Mr. Page was, if we allow people to paint in roadways the phrase Black Lives Matter, somebody else has an opposing political view that BLM is racist, they want to paint that in a roadway. If we allow one, shouldn't we allow the other? Or if we don't allow one, shouldn't we disallow the other?
Well, that is a difficult question. I mean, I certainly subscribe to the idea that Black Lives Matter, and that's really important, and I wish that we could help some more of our white folks understand, why we say that. It's a good point that free speech is free speech, and if the other side wants to write something, then ultimately that's sort of a decision that courts make, isn't it? It does seem like it's not right to cover up one and not cover up the other.
And Debbie Ingram, I want to ask you sort of to differentiate yourself. When voters take the Democratic ballot, those who do on for the August 11th primary, they've got quite a range of folks to choose from for the office of lieutenant governor. It's currently held by progressive Democrat David Zuckerman, who is running for governor. So it's effectively being vacated. And among the folks running for the office now are Tim Ash, the president pro tem of the Senate, and one of your colleagues. Molly Gray is a assistant attorney general. Yourself, Debbie Ingram. Let's see, we have Brenda Siegel from Newfane, who ran for governor, I think, a couple of years ago, and is a candidate of, I guess, a more progressive stripe in the Democratic field. And let's see here if I'm missing anybody. I don't think any of the Democrats or a couple of Republicans.
No, that's all the Democrats.
Okay, I think there are a couple of Republicans running too. But why should people pick Debbie Ingram out of that distinguished panel of candidates here?
Yeah, well, I think, first of all, political elected experience is important in this position. It really matters. And, you know, I have the time in the Senate. I have the time as an elected official on the select board in Williston, municipal experience. So that's, I think that's extremely important, and not all the candidates do. Secondly, I think I have the best record on the most pressing issue facing our society at the moment, on racial justice. I have a long history of long before the George Floyd killing sparked national protests of working on these issues. I've been endorsed by a group called Justice for All. I've introduced legislation to make Indigenous People's Day permanent. I introduced the amendment to the Constitution to clarify the prohibition against slavery. I championed legislation to create the Racial Equity Panel and Executive Director. I championed the Ethnic Studies Bill to look at racism in our education system. I introduced bills on de-escalation of the use of force by police, again, back in December before all of this broke out. So I have, I think, the best record there. And then third, I would say that, you know, this time with coming out of the pandemic and dealing with this racial upheaval, we need somebody who's had some life experience, who's really seasoned and has been through some difficult times. And I've taken some hard knocks in my life and come out stronger on the other side. And I think I can provide that role modeling and support for Vermonters to do the same.
Lieutenant Governor, obviously, he's oftentimes considered sort of a stepping stone to the governor's office. Do you imagine yourself ever serving as governor someday?
Oh, gosh, I can hardly imagine getting to August 11th at this point. So I don't know about that. I really do think my skill set works well for the lieutenant governor job, and I just really want to concentrate on that right at the moment.
Let me go back to the question about it being important to have served in elective office before. Obviously, not all successful candidates for office in the United States fit that category. And I guess, you know, you said it's important a couple times, but why is that? What is it about that having that experience that makes you a cut above?
Well, I think you understand the process better. You know, you might be able to look outside at the, you know, the issues and, you know, feel like you know something about them, but until you see how, you know, the process works up close and you've been through it, and also going through the process helps you to have the relationships with the other decision makers. And, you know, nothing is ever decided by just one person. So you have to work collaboratively and collectively, and you have to really understand the procedures that that make things happen, so that you can actually have an impact.
Debbie Ingram, we're about out of time. I really appreciate you joining me this morning. Thank you so much. And Lieutenant Gubernatorial Candidate Debbie Ingram, she's a Democrat running in the August 11th primary. And we're going to go to some top-of-the-hour news from CBS, folks.
Thank you, Dave.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state? Don your mask and come to the Warren Store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well-stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren Store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
Radio WDEV FM and AM. Now back to the Dave Graham Show.
We're back. Thanks for staying with us into our second hour on this Thursday morning, April. It's July. Come on. Wake up and get the calendar right here, Dave. It's July 23rd, 2020, and we are actually glad for the passage of the past few months given this COVID-19 crisis. Let's hope we are nearer the end of it than we were in April. I'm sure we are. So maybe that's a sign of life. Who knows? Hey, we are going to open the phone lines for the next little bit because we normally talk to one of our CBS News correspondents during this time slot of the Dave Graham Show. We were unable to make that connection this morning, but we do love having our CBS News folks on with us most days. And then Bob Ney on Fridays, of course. We expect Bob will be back tomorrow morning for his weekly appearance as we try to get a national perspective just after the top of the hour. Happy to talk about any national issues that are on the minds of listeners out there this morning, as well as local and state issues, obviously. The numbers here are 244-1777. That's the local number in Waterbury. Toll-free number 1-877-291-8255. And in just a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with Scudder Parker. He is out with a new collection of poetry. Lives in Middlesex and has a book out called Safe as Lightning. It's poems by Scudder H. Parker. And, boy, they really are very nice, interesting to read. And he's a very thoughtful and guy and a gifted poet, I think. Most people who encounter his poetry really like it. And so I'm interested to speak with Scudder Parker in just a few minutes. And we have all sorts of other topics to talk about in the interim, including this question of is Governor Scott actually going to issue a mask mandate possibly as soon as tomorrow? He has his one of his regular news conferences. He's doing them Tuesdays and Fridays now. We carry him live on WDEV FM and AM right after the Dave Graham Show on Tuesdays and Fridays. The other days of the week, the Bill Sayer Common Sense Radio Hour follows our show here. But on Tuesdays and Fridays these days, we've been going to the governor's news conference where he gets together with other top state officials and they talk about what the latest is on the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis. Interesting that the governor is contemplating moving to the mask mandate now. I know Vermont's numbers have tended to be low in recent weeks, certainly in comparison to other states where the COVID-19 crisis is just exploding. Florida, Texas, Arizona, California, certainly. We are relatively lucky up here in the Northeast, in Vermont especially, where we've been able to keep the numbers low. There was a scare down in Manchester last week where there were initial reports of more than 60 positive test results. It ended up being false positives for the most part, and I think a total of 5 confirmed cases of the COVID-19 virus were found in a big round of testing in Bennington County after that initial scary report. So we are obviously still in this state of not being sure how we're going to respond to the COVID-19 crisis. I think it's all in a state of flux. Curious to get listeners' thoughts out there on what they think we should do. For instance, about opening schools in the fall, should they open completely? Try to get as close back to normal as we can. If they do open, should there be various restrictions? Should students be going part-time and working from home part-time via remote means, usually the internet, basically. So lots of questions out there about this COVID-19 crisis, we're going to have to, I guess, sort of feel our way forward through it. It is unlike anything I think any of us has ever seen before in our lives. I guess there are a few people over 100 years old who may have been alive but probably don't remember because they were tiny little infants back during the Spanish flu of 1918 and 1919. We did have a flu pandemic back then. And of course, the world was so much different back then. We had an economy that just wasn't designed the way our current economy is. And our current economy certainly, I think, was shown to be vulnerable to this kind of a shakeup, really. I don't know what kind of an economy you could build that wouldn't be, but boy, this one certainly has been vulnerable. I'm curious to know if there are many people out there who are still working from home. If you have a job where, it's nice to go in normal times, you want to be in the office with your coworkers and bouncing ideas off of each other and having that sort of interplay. But you can also do your job pretty effectively from home. Are you still doing that? Does that make the most sense to you? Are you scared to go back in and start you know, making the daily commute and going back to your old routine, maybe stopping at the coffee shop on the way in, et cetera. And so lots of questions out there for individuals, lots of questions out there for government agencies, for society at large. Are we ever going to get back our performing arts? We had had some folks on in the performing arts realm on the other day, including the terrific actor Luis Guzman, who was born in Puerto Rico and lives in Vermont these days, along with Sarah Grace and Ben Dunham, two musicians. Sarah's a terrific singer, Ben's a bass player and producer, and they were just talking about how they are struggling to try to continue with their artistic expression and endeavors, even though pretty much certainly movie productions have been shut down in recent months. So Luis Guzman hasn't been doing much of that. And the musicians were saying, of course, you know, live gigs are very, very heavily curtailed these days, if not eliminated entirely. That's a very tough thing in Vermont, because normally this is a time of year when we have lots of outdoor concerts, and you know, I know the big there's a big one every September with Grace Potter, and that festival she puts on the Burlington waterfront, not happening this year. So many other summer and early fall events, right up to and including the Tunbridge Fair, canceled this year. So it's tough times, let's face it. And we certainly here at WDEV want to be purveyors of the kind of information that you need, and maybe even some sort of, I don't know, some sort of occasional words of wisdom that'll help you get through the struggle here, because it is a struggle for an awful lot of people. And we have to acknowledge that and try to be kind to one another and take care of one another. And part of taking care, of course, is wearing those masks when you're in public, maintaining that 6 feet of social distancing, following the arrows on the supermarket floor. Not everybody does that. And it's something that would be great if we could get a higher percentage of people who are observant and trying to, make very small changes in their own lives out of consideration for others. That's one of those things that is just would be a terrific thing, and is happening in most cases. So let's be thankful for that too. And we are very happy to bring you this morning a newly published poet in Vermont. He's got a collection out in the form of a book. It's called "Safe as Lightning: Poems by Scudder H. Parker." And Scudder H. Parker is my guest this morning. Scudder, thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Glad to do it. I've been reading these poems, and I got to tell you, I have really been intrigued and enlightened at times, and enjoying them thoroughly. There are a lot of them that are just fun, and a lot of them make you stop and think. And I think it's a good. By the way, this is your debut collection, right?
Well, yeah, debut, and well, maybe not completely my lifetime collection, but it's definitely everything I've written over the years.
Oh, okay. And you have a really interesting background. You were a Protestant minister for a while. You got into politics, ran for the state Senate successfully from Caledonia County for a number of years. I remember you, that when we first met, you were chair of the Senate Finance Committee. And I remember you then later on went on and served in the Department of Public Service and as sort of the energy efficiency czar. I don't remember the official title, but
I preferred the title czar anyway. So yeah.
Okay, Czar Scudder the First or whatever. Yeah,
right. Sure. Efficiency czar.
There we go. And so. And then I gather you retired from state government, and you continue to live in Middlesex, and you are just decided to delve into poetry, or was this a lifelong poetry habit you had that was just kept under wraps for a while?
I think it's pretty much the latter. I wrote a lot of poetry in spurts at various times during my career, and then I'd go 10 or 15 years without writing much because I would get deeply involved in whatever job I was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So it really is something I've done over my lifetime, but frankly, since retiring I've written with much more regularity and intensity than I have in any period in my life.
And I've often been curious about poetry and sort of the approach to poetry. I gather, you know, I've never taken a class in it or whatever, but I gather that there is a fair amount of a kind of technique to it and structure and different styles of poems that you might want to be familiar with as you decide how you're going to express yourself in poetry. Is that right, or am I?
No, that. You're absolutely right, Dave. I think there's a very, well, there's certainly a long history of different forms of poetry and different styles. And I think they're still being invented. One of the nice things about poetry is you really can't strictly define it. It's in very many different forms. But it's really, I think, in a sense, an intensity of language is really what you would try to describe poetry as being, but it can use rhythm, it can use rhyme, it can use sometimes the layout on the page. A lot of modern poetry is being influenced by rap. You know, there's poetry slams where people get up and read, you know, almost chanting their work. And that's not me, unfortunately. I don't quite go there, but it's very wonderful stuff, much of it.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And so if you were standing up in front of an English class right now at, you know, Johnson State College, the University of Vermont or whatever, and you were talking to folks about the poem, I just flipped open to where I had a page turned down here, Art of the Poem. I imagine myself a cook and someone has been stealing my poems again. I just left fresh ones on the windowsill to cool before I could get back. Gone. Sometimes I'm desperate, and when the nephew of a Nigerian prince urgently sends me a small poetry deposit to secure a valuable fortune, I respond at once. Generally, I just leave them on the counter, hoping the children and grandchildren will find them tempting and grab a few in passing, like blueberries. I haunt my wife, latest edits in hand, embarrassed by my urgency. I want her to want to steal these words I have not yet found the way to use in conversation. Wow. That's a really interesting picture that paints to me, because you're basically talking about kind of domestic family life here. And when I read the first few lines, my mind went to chocolate chip cookies.
right. I don't know how many people set out pies on the windowsill these days, but the first two stanzas and hopefully the tone of the whole poem are somewhat self-mocking, you know, just making fun of the urgency that I feel a lot of times, and I assume other poets do, when you've written something and have to share it and want people to like it right away. And then really it's a discussion about what are you really trying to do with a poem, and you're trying to find a way to say something that maybe doesn't have a ready, easy way to get said in the language that we use every day.
Yeah, and I know what you mean about the intensity of language, because I think these poems, and a lot of good poems that I've read over time, you get a sense that the words are chosen very carefully, and they are chosen with things like their shape and their rhythm and the sound of the word very much in mind. So it does seem to be almost a distillation process going on here.
I think that's a good description of it, Dave. And one of the things that goes with that is, at least for me, some people write a first draft and it's nearly done. For me, I write a first draft and then I set it aside or take it to somebody I trust and have them critique it and then work on it again and again and again and again. So there's a lot of work in revising. It's as much the art of writing poetry as that wonderful first draft when you think you've just written the world's best poem, but you have to look at it later.
Yeah, that's interesting, this process of going to somebody you trust and having them give you a critique. I'm wondering, is that anything like, I mean, I can imagine a musician who maybe had just practiced up a piece of music and wants, and is a fairly, you know, advanced musician, maybe in local community or whatever, playing in the local orchestra and that kind of thing.
Right.
But, you know, goes into Boston or up to Montreal to see somebody who's playing in one of the world-class orchestras up there and say, hey, I think I just finally really nailed the adagio to the Mozart clarinet concerto or something.
Right.
And please give it a listen and tell me where I'm going wrong, you know, and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, I think this is something I've thought a lot about and talked a lot about. I think for some people, your writing becomes something that you want more and more to really reach other people and communicate to them. And I think it's often those folks who seek out criticism from people they really respect and who are trusted, thoughtful critics and brutal critics too, you know, who will be honest with you about what doesn't work. What I would also say is you don't have to be that way about poetry to write poetry. Poetry can be just something you write to express your deepest inner feelings. And if that's what it is and you want it to be a private thing, you probably shouldn't take it to someone and ask them to tear it apart because it's your expression of your love or caring or insight. And if you're not ready to have it torn apart, like having a young person go up to Montreal, as you just suggested, and be overwhelmed by the expertise of the professionals, it's better to let it sit, maybe share it with the people close to you and as a way of communicating with them. That's a fine use of poetry, too.
Yeah, it's interesting. The last stanza of the poem that I just picked out here, Art of the Poem, is called, I haunt my wife, latest edits in hand, embarrassed by my urgency, I want her to want to steal these words. I have not yet found the way to use in conversation. And that's a really interesting thought there, because I happen to know your wife too. Susan Sussman was in state government for quite a while. She was, I know, at one point, executive director of the Human Rights Commission. So a lot of folks around here know Susan as well. And so I can sort of picture how sometimes you want to express something to a loved one and you're not finding exactly the right moment, or when the right moment comes, you're not finding exactly the right words. And so here's a way, right? I mean, is that what you're saying?
Yes. And to be honest, I think in a marriage or a close personal relationship, it can be hard because you're asking your loved one to tear apart something you've written. Over time, I think Susan and I have learned how she can say, I like this, this doesn't work. What the heck are you trying to do over here? And I can hear it because we have an agreement that that's what we're doing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't rush to that in a relationship where you hadn't practiced it a bit.
Yeah, I'm sure it's something that does take some practice. And yeah. that kind of
you don't want the writer to go off sulking and hurt, you know, or to have the critic feel, oh my God, what have I done? I've ruined our relationship and whatever.
Yeah,
Susan
right.
Has become a really great critic, and I trust. Sometimes it's just her first response.
You know,
how long is she silent when she reads the poem? What's her first take on it.
So, we actually need to hear some words from our one of our CBS News anchors. We're going to go to the bottom of the hour news break and come back for more of our conversation with poet Scudder Parker in just a few minutes, folks. Stay tuned to the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV FM and AM, and we will be back shortly.
Thank you, Dave.
Are you itching to get out, explore our great state, Don your mask and come to the Warren store in the beautiful Mad River Valley. The store is open to a limited number of customers upstairs and down. Daily takeout by phone or window, but you can finally choose beer, wine, chips, etc. No appointment needed upstairs. Well stocked with cool summer clothing, cards, candles, bags, and jewelry, puzzles and toys for all ages, art supplies, books, and interactive learning games. Are your kids bored and driving you crazy? Bring them to the Warren store. Practicing all safe protocols. Masks required.
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us, folks. My guest is Scudder Parker. He is a poet these days. He passed a state senator, energy efficiency expert and leader at the Department of Public Service, Protestant minister in his past. These days, he is a published poet out with a new collection called Safe as Lightning, poems by Scudder H. Parker. Scudder, did you have a recent event about this at a public venue somewhere, or maybe it was online, given the current conditions? Tell us about what's happening around. Oftentimes, there are events connected with new books.
Great question, Dave, and a completely appropriate one in this time. We were scheduled to have a kickoff jointly sponsored by Rootstock Publishing, which is the publisher of this book, and of Bear Pond Books in Montpelier. And we scheduled that, I think, originally for June 9th, and we ended up having an online Zoom event with about 120 people on the screen at various times in a slightly overwhelming technological experience for me, but it was a lot of fun to be able to read online and have, you know, college friends and kids who'd been in my youth group and people from all over, as well as lots of local people for that event. Yeah.
That's pretty cool. And I got to give a plug here also to Rootstock Publishing, based in Montpelier. They are a very interesting small publishing house, which has come out with a lot of terrific books lately, some of which we have been able to feature here on the Dave Graham Show. And I highly recommend going to their website, Rootstock, Rootstock, Publishing, and checking out their catalog. Some terrific Vermont-based writers, as well as others, getting their work into print, and that is a wonderful thing. And I also have to give a big shout out to Bear Pond Books in Montpelier, which just has I've never come across a bookstore. I mean, I'm sure there are a few around the country, and some of which are pretty famous. In terms of being institutions in their community, but in terms of really reaching out to the community and holding these events that draw a lot of people in and looking for innovative ways to stay connected with the community, Bear Pond Books does a terrific job, I think. And so good combination to have backing your publication here, Scudder. So that's
great. I couldn't agree with you more. And as someone who's an advocate of local agriculture and, you know, local energy sources and efficiency, I guess the local bookstores are another part of that very, very important local infrastructure and culture that, you know, I think makes Vermont pretty unusual, I think, in the way it has institutions that allow people at the local level to connect on a whole range of issues and cultural events. So yes,
I don't want to overdo the extolling of local, all things local, but of course we love local here at WDEV because helping our local economy makes our local economy more likely to help our local radio station. So that's we're all part of the same thing, I think, in some ways. But one thing, if you walk into Bear Pond Books, you can stand in the middle of an aisle there and just imagine to yourself or remind yourself that there's probably no place else on earth exactly like this. I mean, if you go to a Barnes & Noble or Borders or something, they're going to have a huge range of books, and they got the cafe and so on and so forth. And, you know, there's certain temptations there. But you get a sense that wherever you go in the country, and a lot of chains, you know, sort of play up on this, you're going to get the same the same experience from a chain bookstore or a chain restaurant or whatever, wherever you go and find a copy of whatever the franchise is. In this instance, if you go to a local bookstore, you go to a local restaurant, you're going to get a flavor that is unlike, you know, there might be other places similar. You know, a lot of people would find similarities between, you know, Bear Pond Books and maybe Northshire Books in Manchester or, you know, Galaxy Books up in Hardwick. But you can also just remind yourself that in terms of how they organize their displays and what the staff is interested in and talking to you about, et cetera, it's a unique thing when you go into a local business like this. And so very cool in my estimation. It's something to be cherished wherever you
exactly.
are.
But, yeah. And the staff at most of these stores, and I'll mention a couple others, Next Chapter in Barry.
Uh-huh.
And there's the other Bear Pond Books in Stowe, and then the Literary in Morrisville. So all of these places, generally, it's not like going into some massive mega store where the clerk or the staff person doesn't really know about the product. These folks have read the product and made decisions and can make recommendations and give you guidance as well.
Yeah, generally when I go into one of the local bookstores you just mentioned, I find you're gonna basically meet up with a book lover or three or four.
Right.
And that can be a very valuable thing when you're trying to figure out, you know, so, hey, I'm interested in a book on philosophy. Am I going to like Schopenhauer better or should I stick with Husserl or whatever, you know? Let's see here. You are one of the things I find intriguing about your poems also is that they are, and I suppose this is common to a lot of poetry, but it is something that really shines through here, where a lot of this is pretty interior stuff. I mean, it's kind of when it's you sort of thinking to yourself and reflecting on the aspects of nature you see around yourself, the aspects of just human relationships in your own, among your own family and friends, and so on. You also have a poem here called "The Early Memories of Jesus," and that's something that is larger than probably one encounters just in the day-to-day life of gardening or whatever.
Right.
And so, give me your, if you want to read a bit of it, we probably don't have time for it's a fairly long piece, but maybe give us an excerpt and also talk to us about what's behind it and how did your early memories of Jesus maybe lead you to the Protestant ministry for part of your life?
Right. Well, this is definitely, I grew up as a, well, I became a preacher's kid in high school when my father left farming and went into the ministry, which was also sort of his father's profession. And many of my ancestors were also Protestant ministers as well. So it's sort of, we joke about it as sort of the family default profession. So a lot of my writing is about my spiritual journey and searching and trying to appropriate my religious tradition in a way that makes sense to me in the present. Yeah. Yes.
Do you want to read some from it?
Yes, I'm actually looking for it. What page do you have it on, David?
I have it on page 26 through...
There you go.
20 through 30. Wow, 29 rather.
Well, it's too long to read, but... Yep.
Let's see here. I'm going to read a little section of it and ask you about it.
Okay. I've got it now.
Here we go. Despite my parents' confidence in God's good intentions, I never believed that Jesus was... This is section two. I never believed that Jesus was overcome by charity when he relinquished that inheritance where the sheep stay forever painted on the hills. What does that mean?
Well, for me, it's the experience of connection with my religious tradition is very much a specific lived experience, not a sort of generalization about life or an abstraction about what's good and bad. So what I do in this is project onto Jesus the sense that Jesus didn't come to play out an abstract story of forgiveness, but to bring the openness to a kind of connection with people that is possible but not always experienced. So I suggested by saying that Jesus was trying to get away from the kind of religious portrayal of what spirituality is in the abstract to something that was dynamic and alive. And in a sense, that meant he had to get away from God to live the specifics of a human life. That doesn't mean that he abandoned God or that God abandoned him, but there is something about having to live your life in the specific circumstances of your family, your community, your time in history that is unique and can't be replicated by anyone else. And my belief is that the true spiritual tradition respects that and understands that and welcomes that.
That is fascinating. And actually, I think maybe there's a metaphor here where, you know, people talk about Jesus is God become flesh and blood. And therefore, if you become flesh and blood, you have to live a life in a pretty specific way.
Right.
You know, that's just your, it's going to be your path in the world. You can't basically, you know, live and breathe and eat concepts and aphorisms and instructions about what is good and evil or any of it. You have to actually live your own life and, you know, find food to eat and deal with other people and get through your daily stuff. And
right.
So that's it's interesting to see you kind of bring that all the way forward a couple thousand years and reflect it in your poetry here. Another fascinating bit of reading here, folks. That poem, I found it very intriguing, and I suspect others other folks might as well. So I do recommend it. The title poem, Safe as Lightning, also very, I mean, this is one where you are, I think, just thinking really deeply here and expressing it so well. Long before guilt was invented, this stream managed rocks without it. Never a threat or a weedle, just shifted them when strength was gathered. Changes from every storm were there for my exploration. That's how its small riffles and dark pools became such freedom for me. Neither worms I pierced nor speckled fish I hooked cried out in accusation. In turn, they claimed me, taught me to fin in place beneath a dark green overhang of rock. Very, very specific description. You know, beneath a dark green overhang of rock, you are in a place that is not like every place else. That's for sure, right there.
Right.
And right. And you're learning, but you are learning, I think, some broader things about the world from that specific place. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And what I think is that sometimes in my experience of the religious tradition, I'm not trying to speak for anyone else, the experience of the way it's taught to us or enforced on us, to be honest, or was on me, sometimes made me feel like parts of my experience were outside the realm of what could be holy and what could be full of meaning. And I think this poem is really about saying that all of your life is open to that sort of magic and the amazing, startling experience of discovering its meaning and its power. And you shouldn't make a rule in the beginning that here's the deal. You've got to do this to get rewarded. The deal is you've got to open yourself and experience it.
Yeah, I think you're that process of kind of receiving God or Jesus and really having it reflected through your own soul is that's where I hear you basically gaining what feels like genuine faith from that process, and that's a wonderful thing. Hey, I want to bring in a listener who's on the line. Fred from Newbury is calling in. Good morning, Fred.
Morning. Hey,
good morning.
Some of the best love poetry that was ever written was written by the lyricists who wrote the American Songbook. Have you ever heard any of them?
Oh, sure, Cole Porter and I mean, I think that there is some wonderful stuff there for sure. Scudder Parker, actually, what do you think about lyrics to songs as poetry? I mean, Bob Dylan just won the Nobel Prize for literature, and you know,
he kind of scorned it a little bit, but yes, he did. And I thought that was, you know, that was a wonderful and remarkable action on their part. What I would say is lyrics are definitely poetry. When people say, "Oh, I don't like poetry," I learned in the third grade. I had to learn Thanatopsis or some heavy duty poem that I memorized and still don't understand. What I say is, you better listen to all the songs that you enjoy and love, and it could be Dylan, it could be rap music, it could be Ross Gay, this absolutely wonderful, almost singing rapper. Yes, those are poetry. The thing about the kind of poetry I write is you have to make all the music in the text itself. You don't have the music to go along as an accompaniment. And that makes it even more of a challenge, I think. But that is not to say that the lyrics of those poems aren't great poetry. Of course they are. Absolutely.
Yeah, one of my favorite, in terms of sort of pop musicians or folk musicians or whatever, one of my other favorites is Joni Mitchell. I think some of her lyrics rose to the level.
Oh, absolutely. And her lyrics are... they're complex, they're complicated, they do the same things that a lot of poems do. Put up a parking lot.
Yeah.
It's just the images just whack you over the head.
For sure. Hey, I wanted to get back to the sort of formal nature of poetry, because it's something that I never took a course in it, and I don't really understand. But how would you, if you were teaching an English class called Understanding Poetry to college students or high school students or whatever, how would you describe Safe as Lightning, the form of it?
If I were teaching it to students, I wouldn't start by describing the form. I would say, read it and tell me what you feel and what you think in response to it.
The form is
something I find as I write it and as I work on it and revise it. And it hopefully is the kind of nearly invisible vehicle by which the communication is assisted or actually takes shape. So I wouldn't start out by doing that unless I wanted them, if it was a class and they wanted to experiment with, write a sonnet, write something else. That's perfectly appropriate to do. But I don't start with the form. I say start with what your experience is, what your insight is, and then see what happens at that insight deepens and you see connections to something else. What is being in this place make you feel? What does it make you think? And how does that connect to other things? And that's what really this is about. It's sort of, this poem is about, you know, the whole threat and promise way that many of us have gotten raised. and it's not probably a bad thing in some measure, but life isn't a bargain with an authority figure. Life is connection with the spirit that's around us. And, you know, the beaver pond is my image of that. It's sort of this thing that suddenly it's there and it creeps through the woods, and you're walking through the woods and suddenly the ground is wet and slippery and you realize the beaver have let the water flow through that poor part of the woods where it's never been before. And there's a newness to that. That's really what this is about. It's discovering the flash of lightning, which is just this instantaneous and powerful thing, not being preoccupied with with the thunder, which is sort of the lumbering, grumbling argument about what life means.
You know, I think that some of what is going on here is almost, and I'm not an expert in this field either, but there seems to be a meditative aspect to looking at things very, very carefully and really focusing and then trying to express what you're seeing in words. I mean, that's seems to be some of the process here. I'm looking at the poem Visitation, which basically I think describes your encounter with a beetle. And
yeah.
Perhaps it was our carpet, the color of vast deserts, that lured the black beetle of elegant orange Fabergé design. For all I know, it teleported from Tunisia in the early 13th century, or the early 13th century. It stayed for days. Wherever it was from, whatever time, I'm certain, in the universe of beetles, it was no extraordinary thing to do. It was my noticing, the surprise of its beauty, my urge to have it stay, that made it a visitation. Its calm precision, the orange on such perfect black, the cats showed studious respect. I don't know where it went, but there are tiny fractures in the rules that shape me. I think I become more patient. There was no promise of return. I mean, that sounds almost like a Buddhist meditation there to some extent. Am I on the right track, or am I going crazy here?
Right. I'm not putting a particular religious title on it, but I think you're right. It's that moment when you see something that you might have seen 100 or 1,000 times, and maybe not this beetle on the carpet, but it sort of stands for that. Mm-hmm. Where you've seen something before, but you see it this time in a way you've never seen it before. And that is what poetry is. Dave, you know, I wanted to just mention that as a preacher, I spent a lot of time doing summary. You know, sermons were often, here's the point I want to make.
Yeah, right.
And there's a way that poetry for me is a kind of unlearning of that temptation. It's a way of saying, here's the specific, what do we learn from it? What's the experience? And be present in that moment, feel it, feel the connections that it makes to other parts of your life or the world you live in, and you experience it that way. So in writing, one of the things I do is I often write a poem and then find that in the end of the poem, I've written a great summary and conclusion, and I have to chop that off and
go with the specifics. Hey, Scudder Parker, we're about out of time, but I really appreciate you taking the time with us this morning. And this is terrific stuff. Safe as Lightning, Poems by Scudder H. Parker is the book. Thanks, Scudder, very much.
Thank you, Dave. It's great to be on with you, and congratulations on your new career, too.
Thanks. I love it. Hey, that's about it for the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, FM, and AM. Stay tuned for Bill Sayre, Common Sense Radio. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of our show, folks.